or Weekend Edition.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning from Washington. This hour, more questions about President Trump's blanket pardon for those charged with storming the Capitol on January 6th, after the arrest of a Virginia man for allegedly planting pipe bombs that day. And Waymo self-driving cars used to be quite deferential to other cars on the road.
Waymos were like a surefire. They will always let you go.
But now a programming update has them acting more like human drivers. Plus, Idaho residents fight an invasion of roof-climbing rats. It's Sunday, December 7th. News is next.
For KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. As artificial intelligence becomes more ubiquitous with modern-day life, the demand for data centers is growing, and developers are increasingly looking away from urban places to build them. Rural America offers plenty of space to develop renewable energy sources in sprawling campuses, and rural communities usually have more relaxed regulatory processes for construction compared to dense urban centers. In the land of 10,000 lakes, data center developers may be attracted to tax breaks offered by the Minnesota legislature in 2025, in addition to the state's cold climate. While about 80 data centers are concentrated around the Twin Cities, more are being built in suburban and rural areas. Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, is slated to open a data center in Rosemount in 2026. 12 more hyperscale data centers are in various phases of exploration in the state, including a Hermantown project that has been on hold since mid-November. These projects bring promises of construction jobs, technician jobs, and a boost to local property tax revenue, but some environmental and grassroots groups are concerned about how data centers can negatively impact rural communities.
There's a lot of capacity, technical capacity and expertise that comes with being in the metro area that rural Minnesota and rural municipalities and communities just don't have. There's not a consistency of access to engineers and hydrologists and all of that's entailed to manage these complex projects.
That was Peg Fershong from CURE, a rural environmental advocacy group that focuses on issues in greater Minnesota during the November meeting of the Environmental Quality Board. During this meeting, the EQB hosted its second informational session on data centers with a focus on water resources. Data centers are essentially warehouses that host servers that power the internet, from mobile phone applications to sensitive government data systems. The servers are seldom powered off due to the 24/7, 365 demands of internet users, requiring more systems to cool them down. That's where data centers can call for large volumes of water. In the data center regulations cleared by the legislature at the end of last session, the State Department of Natural Resources can inquire about water resources as developers plan out data centers. From the DNR, Assistant Ecological and Water Resources Director Jason Meckel explains to EQB board members.
What's the geology? Therefore, what do we know about the availability of water? What are the existing users in the area? What kind of natural resources are associated with those aquifers? And given an understanding of what's proposed for how the water will be used, when it will be used, how it will be pumped, what might the constraints be at that given site?
The DNR issues water appropriations permits when projects are expected to use at least 100 million gallons per year. While Minnesota is a very wet state, there are frequent periods of drought, and aquifers can draw down in the summer with agriculture's irrigation demands. Steve Robertson from the Minnesota Department of Health says cities with municipal water systems have much to consider when approving data center developments.
There's the general issue of maintaining the public trust. So with a public water system, that's a key consideration. It's largely because new large developments of all kinds, including those involving new large volume water users, really bear on maintaining or stewarding the public trust relative to delivering a product like drinking water that many people prioritize for their own public health protection.
If the data center plans include establishing a new water supply, that can affect private well owners as well, Robertson says.
It would not be unusual for a new large volume water user to satisfy its needs by developing a new source of supply. In Minnesota, that's most commonly going to be with a new well. And the principal issue that this presents to the local community is that a new well has the potential to alter the groundwater flow regime in a significant way.
If a new large well is established, nearby smaller wells with shorter straws may have difficulty accessing the water from the same aquifer. Information from these data center sessions in October and November is slated to help guide further work for the Environmental Quality Board focused on its two priorities, supporting program development on emerging environmental issues and to improve the state's environmental review program. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
It's Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. The Kennedy Center honors happen tonight at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts here in Washington. President Trump says he's hosting and emceeing the event himself, and yet another departure from tradition. But it puts the president in a familiar position as a showman and has the promise to be a pleasant diversion for Trump from some unwelcome political realities waiting for him off stage. And that's where we'll start with NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning, Aisha.
So January 6th has dogged the president since the attack on the Capitol in 2021. Now, one of the major mysteries of that day has the potential, if proven, to be another drag on him. I'm talking about those pipe bombs found near the Democratic and Republican Party headquarters.
That's right. For years in the MAGA world, the pipe bomber, alleged pipe bomber, was described as an Antifa plant or some kind of an inside job. It turns out that the suspect, from what we know, the alleged pipe bomber, is a Trump supporter. And we also know that Deputy FBI Director Dan Bongino, before he came into the administration, trafficked in those conspiracy theories, claiming that the pipe bomb episode was an inside job. But now the facts seem completely at odds with what he used to say. And here's what Bongino told Sean Hannity on Fox to explain this.
I was paid in the past, Sean, for my opinions. That's clear. And one day I'll be back in that space. But that's not what I'm paid for now.
In other words, back then when Bongino said he had no doubt that the placement of the pipe bombs was a setup, he says now, quote, I'm paid to be your deputy FBI director and we base investigations on facts. In other words, before the facts didn't matter, he was paid to make stuff up. Now he's paid to pay attention to reality. And that is a startling reversal.
The facts of January 6th, many of them adjudicated by courts, many of them admitted to under oath by their perpetrators, they never have seemed to matter to the president. His blanket pardon issued on January 20th of this year requires the Justice Department to, and I quote here, pursue dismissal with prejudice to the government of all pending indictments against individuals for their conduct related to the events at or near the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021. unquote. Would that include the case against Brian Cole Jr., the man who has been arrested for these pipe bombs?
It certainly sounds like it could. We know from reporting that Brian Cole has told law enforcement officials that he believed the claims put forward by Donald Trump and his supporters that the 2020 election was rigged and stolen. Those claims are false. So now does it mean that Trump is going to preemptively pardon him, just like he pardoned the 1,500 or so January 6 rioters? Some of them were convicted of assaulting police officers. We'll see. But we do know that the January 6 lie that Donald Trump actually won the 2020 election is so fundamental to Trump's political identity and to MAGA's core beliefs that it suggests he might get a pardon.
Trump and House Republicans got good news from the Supreme Court about their efforts to redraw Texas congressional districts to tilt them heavily toward GOP candidates. Does that mean the party in power, the Republicans, will defy midterm political reality?
And political gravity. It could. There are two big forces working at cross purposes in the 2026 midterms. The first one is the fundamentals, public opinion turned against the Republican Party. Donald Trump's approval ratings are very low. Democrats so far have either won or overperformed in every single off-year election this cycle. But the other force is structural, and that's where Republicans have a lot of advantages, especially in this mid-cycle partisan gerrymandering, where they will be able to carve out more Republican-leaning districts in red states than Democrats will be able to carve out Democratic-leaning districts in blue states. And if Republicans can net 5, 6, 7, 9, 10 extra seats, they could defend themselves against a big blue wave if there is one developing.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's the epicenter of suffering in the world right now. That's how the UN's top humanitarian and emergency relief official, Tom Fletcher, described the situation in Darfur. The region in Sudan has recently witnessed some of the worst violence of the country's civil war. The conflict is now in its third year, with tens of thousands killed and millions displaced by the fighting. Tom Fletcher recently visited Darfur and joins us now in studio. Welcome to the program.
Many thanks, Aisha. Thanks for having me on.
So, Tom, what did you see and hear on the ground?
It's a horror show. And I had a week inside Darfur, and you're going through checkpoint after checkpoint manned by child soldiers. You're meeting people who are starving, who've been displaced many times, victims of sexual violence, victims of horrible torture, brutality. I met one lady who'd escaped from El Fasha. She'd seen her own child killed in front of her, her husband killed in front of her. She'd gone next door to her neighbors who were all killed in front of her, and she'd scooped up the one survivor, a two-month-old malnourished kid. She'd walked miles and miles to escape, and on the way, she'd been gang raped, she'd had her leg broken, but somehow she'd got to us, and we were looking after her. We were saving that child's life, and we were trying to help them turn the corner. But that's just one story among thousands.
It's just horrific. You said, you know, that aid agencies were trying to help in that situation you described. Are people there getting the aid that they desperately need?
Well, we're there on the ground and we're saving as many lives as we can, but we're only 32% funded. So we are making these brutal life and death choices every day about which lives to save, literally, which projects to cut, which projects to keep. So we're doing our best. We're getting particularly food in, which is so, so vital right now, trying to get medicine in, trying to stand up some of the essential health services. But we're overwhelmed because we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people escaping. And that's just from El Fasher alone, let alone across the whole of Sudan, where the needs are enormous.
There's been widespread reports of massacres in the city of El Fasher. They were allegedly carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, a paramilitary force fighting against the government. The RSF claims it's investigating the massacres, but do we know how many people were killed?
So we don't for sure at the moment. And I was in Tawila and Korma, the two towns very, very close to El Fasher. So I spent time with survivors. The reality at the moment is that El Fasher, as we've seen from the satellite footage, is a crime scene right now. So we're looking to get teams in. Alongside our humanitarians, there'll be teams of investigators going in to try to piece together what's happened and to try to push for accountability. We've got to have people held to account for this crime, but then also we're working on the ground to stop the next atrocity, to try and make sure that civilians elsewhere don't have to suffer the same abuses.
Well, how do you do that?
Very, very difficult to do, particularly as, you know, we're not going in with guns and sort of peacekeeping forces. We're going in as humanitarians with aid. But part of the solution is to get our people in there. You know, the UN isn't a ship that was built to stay in the harbor. We should be close to where people are suffering and try to prevent more atrocities. But then we need the world to act. We need the Security Council to wake up. We need the great powers of the world to basically say, let's stop arming this conflict. The last thing that Darfur needs right now, that Sudan needs right now, is more guns and bullets. They need food and medicine.
Well, why do you think this conflict hasn't received more international attention from world leaders?
Well, I mean, that is the million-dollar question. I mean, maybe the billion-dollar question, actually. I think it's partly that people are distracted, there's apathy, people are anxious about their own lives, understandably. You know, we're going through a tough economic situation in the world right now. I think social media plays a part. You know, it's shortened our attention spans. It's made it harder to focus on the suffering of people on the other side of the world. There are obviously multiple crises as well. You know, we're also dealing with Gaza, we're dealing with the Democratic Republic of Congo, with Myanmar, with Haiti, with so many of these horrific crises globally. And I think there's a lot of disinformation out there. People are being told, you know, we shouldn't have to care about the suffering on the other side of the world. But actually, the reality is we do, because unless we get out there and deal with these massive crises at source, then these problems are coming in our direction too.
And when you say they're coming in our direction, how so?
Because unless you basically respond to these humanitarian crises with generosity and solidarity, then actually you can't put a wall around a pandemic. You can't put a wall around millions of people who will flee from conflict and climate crisis. You can't put a wall around the economic inequality which will spread from these epicenters of violence and suffering. You know, the world is tough right now. It's a brutal period of indifference and apathy. And, you know, we're out there on the front line seeing that. I think I'm the only person in the world this year to go to Gaza twice, to Darfur twice, to Kupiansk on the front lines of the Russia-Ukraine war, to Goma in eastern DRC where the fighting is raging. I get to see the worst of inhumanity, I'm afraid, but I also see the best of humanity in the people who are out there responding. And we need that outpouring of generosity. I refuse to believe that people have lost that sense of human solidarity and generosity.
That's Tom Fletcher, the UN's top humanitarian and emergency relief official. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Aisha.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from the Itasca Orchestra and Strings Program's Family Christmas on Saturday, September 20th at 4 p.m. at the Rife in Grand Rapids, bringing the snowman to life with a film projection and live orchestra music to accompany. Tickets and info available at itascaorchestra.org/events. The Grand Rapids chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness has a holiday gift drive for those hospitalized with mental illness. New, unwrapped, safe gifts may be dropped off now through December 16th at several locations, including KAXE, Coleraine Public Library, and the McCrosty Arts Center. Ideas include art supplies, puzzle books, gloves, or gift cards. Now we'll take you back to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE, KBXE.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told a defense forum at the Ronald Reagan Library last night that the Trump administration's strikes on alleged drug traffickers will continue as part of a strategy to defend the Western Hemisphere. Democrats have called the military strikes illegal, and several say full video of the strikes should be released to the public. Ranking Senate Intelligence Committee member Mark Warner is calling on Hegseth to resign. Japan's defense minister today lodged a protest with China after Chinese military aircraft locked radar on Japanese fighter jets. The incident occurred this weekend near Okinawa. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Air traffic controller often shows up on list of most stressful occupations. And recent events haven't made things any easier. The government shutdown, when air traffic controllers missed two full paychecks, tragic plane crashes and near misses, and chronic understaffing. The Federal Aviation Administration is short more than 3,000 controllers nationwide. So what's the job really like? Emily Hanoka worked for the Federal Aviation Administration for nearly a decade, most recently at Reagan Washington National Airport. She left in June. She joins us now from Colorado Springs, Colorado. Emily, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You stuck with this job for more than 9 years. What did you like about being an air traffic controller?
Every day was different, and the pace was always extremely fast. And that was something I really enjoyed. I left work, and I could leave work behind me. And every day that I plugged in, every hour that I plugged in, the equation was different. And that was really exciting to me.
So what was the hardest part of the job?
The schedule. The schedule was definitely the hardest part. I think managing the schedule, managing home, and the hardest part was really just getting to work and being focused, being rested. Every shift meant that I was sacrificing time with my family. If I worked during the day, I usually left for work before anybody in my household was even awake. If I worked a night shift, obviously I'm missing bedtime with my three kids, and I'm coming home and everybody's already asleep. So every single shift for pretty much every controller, you're sacrificing some major aspect of family time.
I mentioned that you left in June. Why did you leave?
I loved being an air traffic controller, but the sacrifice with my family, we couldn't rationalize that anymore.
You were at DCA, though, in January when there was that American Airlines crash. That must have been hard. Did it change the job for you?
It absolutely changed it for me. I was not on schedule that evening. I worked a day shift the day of the crash, and I worked the following morning. But it really did change a lot from my perspective. It was really hard. A lot of controllers that were on the shift when the accident happened, I don't expect they'll ever return to air traffic.
You hear a lot from regulators and from different lawmakers about how the different systems at the airports need to be updated. They need to be modernized. What was your view on that? How did that affect you?
Yeah, so I had the privilege of working at three FAA facilities, and those three FAA facilities had varying degrees of technology. I started my career in Jackson, Mississippi, and the technology we were using there was incredibly antiquated. We got a technology upgrade in 2019 there to a radar system that when I went to my second facility, they had had since the early 1990s. So technology is very, very slow to implement across all of the facilities within the National Airspace System.
There's been a lot of news or a lot in the news about understaffing at the FAA. How does that impact air traffic controllers?
It makes it more stressful. We also, I think, as a profession, have this sense of responsibility for the airspace. But for the past 10 years, when I got in the FAA in 2015, it's always been a staffing crisis. Staffing has not gotten any better in the 10 years since I've been a part of it. Controllers are taking on more and unfortunately not getting much out of it.
With the staffing shortages, what do you think could be done to get more people wanting to get into the industry?
I think there's a pretty good amount of people that want to join the workforce. The problem is how we onboard people. It's a slower process. The FAA Academy in Oklahoma City can only take on so many controllers and train them per year before they go to FAA facilities for live training. I think what could be done, though, is maintaining the controllers that are currently operational. I think now I've seen more people walk away than ever before, particularly people with my level of experience, about a decade, people halfway through their careers are walking away.
I imagine that you fly on occasion with your family. Do you feel like it remains a safe way to travel, or it will remain a safe way to travel if changes aren't made?
Oh, I absolutely believe that it is a safe way to travel. I stand behind getting on a plane every single day. The FAA does a great job of saying, hey, this facility does not quite have the staffing. And instead of making those controllers work more aircraft, they slow the equation down.
That's Emily Hanoka. She's a former air traffic controller. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today is the deadline for millions of Americans 65 and older to choose Medicare options for the upcoming year. For many, the choice is between traditional Medicare and Medicare Advantage, where the federal government lets private companies manage the coverage. As the Midwest Newsroom's Macy Byers reports, Medicare Advantage plans can come with some risk.
When Americans turn 65, they typically enroll in Medicare. Choosing the best coverage option can be complicated, with options of supplementary coverage, drug prices, and private plans. Independent insurance agent Rick Cuttiford works with Nebraska-based Saving Seniors Money, one group that helps seniors compare traditional Medicare versus a private Medicare Advantage plan.
We don't push people one way or the other. Our job is to educate people about both options, and then whatever they are comfortable with, we go with for their coverage.
Traditional Medicare supplement coverage, often called Medigap, has premiums that can range from about $30 to well over $600 a month. Advantage plans often come with extra benefits like dental or vision, but their most enticing selling point is low-cost monthly premiums. This year, more than half of Medicare beneficiaries, nearly 36 million people, are enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, according to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Jeremy Nordquist, president of the Nebraska Hospital Association, says Advantage plans have provider networks, co-pays, and may require approval before covering a medical service. That can leave patients waiting for care or filling hospital beds that other patients could use.
If you don't think you're going to need health care, great, fine. But very few seniors are healthy enough to avoid that. So they need to know these challenges up front.
Ivan Mitchell is the CEO of Great Plains Health in central Nebraska. He says there are too many claim denials with Advantage plans, and doctors can spend more time on the phone with insurers than helping patients. Great Plains Health stopped accepting Medicare Advantage last January.
There are about 400 members that if they call for an appointment, we do not see them. We will not schedule an appointment with them. They have to go somewhere else for care.
Great Plains Health isn't alone. According to the trade publication Becker's Hospital Review, 40 health systems in the U.S. have decided to drop at least one Medicare Advantage plan this year. The federal government pays Advantage plan companies per enrollee each month to distribute their benefits. The nonpartisan Medicare Payment Advisory Commission estimates those payments added $84 billion to this year's total Medicare expenditures. That extra amount frustrates critics like Mitchell.
We've basically raided the Medicare Trust Fund with these for-profit insurance companies that, in my opinion, have been extremely unethical in what they've done.
Unethical behavior that he says includes insurance companies underpaying health systems like his or causing them to lose money through extra administrative work caused by claim issues. Nonprofit advocacy group Better Medicare Alliance believes Medicare Advantage can offer more value and choice to seniors. CEO Mary Beth Donahue says the insurance industry has told the Trump administration they will take steps to streamline the claims process.
We see that any kind of delay is unacceptable, and so there are new rules and an industry commitment that they've made to the administration to speed up the decisions.
Meanwhile, bipartisan bills have been introduced in Congress calling for more transparency in the Medicare Advantage program. They aim to help seniors the next time they make their health coverage decisions. For NPR News, I'm Macy Byers in Lincoln, Nebraska.
The Midwest Newsroom is a collaboration including NPR and member stations in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. Waymo's self-driving cars seem to be going their own way lately. Some of them have been seen abruptly shifting lanes, taking illegal U-turns, and making risky maneuvers to get passengers where they're going. It's all because of a change in programming to make the vehicles confidently assertive, according to the company. Catherine Binley is a tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's written about the changes in how Waymo has been operating, and she joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, can you tell us like a bit about Waymo? What did their cars used to drive like until recently?
Early on, they were just so deferential is really like the word that comes to mind, or polite. An example I like to give people to help illustrate this is, you know, you arrive at a four-way stop, and it's a tie. And, you know, it's kind of usually like whoever the more assertive driver is goes. People obviously, you know, they don't always default to the car on the right going. And Waymos were like a surefire. They will always let you go.
But it sounds like these self-driving cars have started acting more human and, you know, impatient and get me around here. Like, how have people described their recent experiences in Waymos?
Yeah, they're more confident and they are absolutely driving, or some of them at least are driving more the way that a human would. So if you come to a stop these days with a Waymo in San Francisco, if the Waymo beat you, the Waymo's going to go, or is more likely to go than it previously would have. They've been observed not signaling before changing lanes. What else? Let's see. Oh, well, there was this illegal U-turn down in San Bruno. I spoke with a police sergeant who was out on patrol one night. And they were looking for drunk drivers, and a Waymo pulled a U-turn, and they looked up and there was a no U-turn sign. So they pulled the Waymo over, which obviously is just kind of humorous in and of itself. There's no person, but the window rolled down. And then, you know, an operator apparently came on the speaker and, you know, apologized profusely and said that they were going to look into it.
Well, I mean, that is interesting, though, because the police can't really give a ticket to a driverless car, right?
In California, they cannot, but that law is set to change. So apparently they will, in the future, be able to ticket driverless cars.
So you reached out to Waymo. What did they have to say about this change in their car's behavior?
You know, they were clear that Waymos are designed to respect the rules of the road. There's no intentional, you know, make the Waymos bend rules or anything like that. But they have intentionally made the Waymos, as they put it, more confidently assertive. And I spoke with a senior director of product management over there, and he explained that if the cars are too passive, that actually can be disruptive to traffic.
Well, how does Waymo's safety record overall compare to human drivers?
According to the company, compared with human drivers, Waymos have had 91% fewer crashes involving a serious injury or worse. So they have, you know, according to them, a strong safety record. And, you know, I think it's fair to consider how people drive, and especially in the age of distraction. I mean, I've lost count to the number of times I'm behind someone and I can see that their eyes are down on their phone, or you pull up next to someone and you can see that they're texting and not paying any attention. You know, some people have told me that they prefer a Waymo because they're not worried that the Waymo is going to be distracted. So it makes sense that people would feel quite comfortable with them in some senses.
That's Catherine Binley of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest in the story and having me on.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The number of death row inmates executed across the U.S. spiked dramatically this year to a level not seen in more than a decade. That's alarming opponents of the death penalty, who say public opinion is increasingly against executions. Joining us now is Kat Stromquist from the Gulf States Newsroom. She's reported extensively on the issue. Welcome to the program.
Hey there.
So just how different is this year in terms of executions?
So if you're just looking at the total number of executions, this year really sticks out. So far this year, 44 people have been executed. That's up from 25 last year. I spoke to Robin Marr at the Death Penalty Information Center, which tracks capital punishment. And she says one state is driving the increase, Florida.
The only reason there's an increase in this year's total number compared to other years is because Governor DeSantis personally scheduled a record number of executions in Florida.
She's referring to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis here. He's overseen 17 executions so far this year.
So why are there so many executions in Florida?
Well, I reached out to Governor DeSantis' office, and his staff directed me to some remarks he made at a press conference in November. Basically, he says, early on in his term, COVID, quote, threw a wrench into our corrections, end quote. Now he says he's responding to families of the victims of crimes that were, in some cases, committed years ago, and he owes them justice.
And it's like, you know, there's a saying, justice delayed is justice denied.
I also spoke to Grace Hanna, the executive director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, an advocacy group. She says the narrative about families of the victims doesn't always check out, noting there are victim family members who oppose executions. Hannah says it's been a difficult time for the men on death row in Florida.
I think the men are scared. They talk about when, you know, they hear the doors on their wing open and they see the guards walk in or the warden walk in. They kind of wonder whose cell they are going to stop at that day.
What else stood out about this year?
So one thing is the limited scope of capital punishment. Executions were largely concentrated in just four states: Texas, South Carolina, Alabama, and Florida. States also continue to try these different methods of execution, in part as a workaround to difficulty obtaining the drugs used for lethal injection. In Alabama, the state continued to execute people using the controversial nitrogen gas method this year. Louisiana also carried out its first execution using that method. And in South Carolina, we saw a few people put to death by firing squad.
Well, what do experts predict could happen next year?
You know, it's hard to know, but Robin Marr of the Death Penalty Information Center says she doesn't expect a single unusual year like this one to change the general downward trajectory of capital punishment since around the year 2000. And surveys show American support for the death penalty has been declining for decades. But Marr says politics is a wild card here. The Trump administration supports the death penalty, and remember, President Biden did not. Experts also tell me that in recent years, the Supreme Court is intervening less in these cases. So that was previously a check in this system that isn't happening as often these days.
That's Kat Stromquist of the Gulf States Newsroom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KAXE KBXE is a proud member of AMPERS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. AMPERS helps support 17 independent community radio stations like KAXE KBXE throughout Minnesota. AMPERS is not affiliated with, nor does it receive funding from Minnesota Public Radio or Minnesota Public TV stations. Many of the AMPERS stations were receiving and have now lost federal funding. The $3.5 million loss accounted for as much as half of some of the station's operating revenue. Despite these cuts, community radio is defunded, not defeated, but we need your help. In addition to supporting KAXE KBXE, we ask that you consider donating AMPERS' statewide effort to keep community radio on the dial. Donate online today at ampers.org. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Talks in Miami between U.S. negotiators and representatives of Ukraine have concluded. Ukraine's President Zelensky said on social media that he is determined to continue working with the U.S. toward peace in Ukraine. President Trump is hosting the Kennedy Center Awards show tonight in Washington. He will be the first president to do so. In India, a deadly fire erupted in a popular nightclub in Goa State. Officials say at least 25 are known dead. Eyewitnesses were reported as saying it appeared the fire began on a crowded dance floor. The club is situated on the backwaters of the Arpura River, a tourist destination known for its sandy beaches. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I'm great. How are you, Aisha?
I am good. Glad to be back. Will, could you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yeah, it was a cute one from Al Gorey of Cozy Lake, New Jersey. I said, name a place where games are played, move the last two letters to the beginning, change the new last letter to an H, and the result, sadly, is what you might have when you leave this place. And the answer was casino. Do those operations, and you might leave that place with no cash.
Okay, well, there were 2,056 correct entries, and this week's winner is Mike Rombach of Pleasanton, California. Congratulations, Mike.
Thank you very much.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
Well, as we often do, my wife and I listened together, and then the first word that popped into my mind was casino, and she immediately said, no cash.
Oh, really? So y'all just got it just like that?
Yep, that's how we did it.
Well, and so why are you the one representing the couple on the show today?
That's a good question, because I'm the one who sent him the answer.
You sent it, so she didn't do it. Okay, okay. Well, Mike, I got to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I am as ready as it gets, so.
All right. Take it away, Will.
All right, Mike and Aisha. I'm going to give you clues for two words. Switch the first and last letters of the answer to the first clue to get the answer to the second. For example, if I said nutmeg or ginger and long heroic poems, you would say Spice and Epics, because Spice starts and ends with the S-E, switch the order with E-S, and you get Epics, which are long heroic poems.
Okay.
Right. Stunned silence. Here we go. Number one is make a grand speech and the muse of love poetry.
Make a grand muse of love poetry. Grand.
Let's say you're speaking at a political convention. What five-letter word would be to make a grand speech?
I'm drawing a blank.
Okay, I tell you what, I'm going to tell you this one. It's to orate, O-R-A-T-E.
Oh, yeah.
Switch the O and the E and you get erato, which was the muse of love poetry.
Oh, God. Okay. That one up.
So now we're off and running. Here you go. Here's your new number one. What a skull and crossbones signifies.
Pirates.
Oh, not pirate. No, it is six letters, though.
Poison?
It could be that, but what more generally?
More generally.
It's a word that means peril or hazard.
Danger?
Danger, yes. Switch the D and the R. What do you get?
D and the R. Ranged?
Ranged is wandered around. Good job. Words to a song. And your second clue is saint for whom the Russian alphabet is named.
It's lyric and Cyril.
Yes, that's it. Lyric to Cyril.
Cyril.
That's how we get the Cyrillic alphabet. Yep. Your first one is yell. Your second clue is amounts equal to 10 $100 bills.
$10 $100 bills.
What is the yell in five letters?
Yell in five letters. $10 $100 bill.
Oh, okay. So if you're loud and you're going, twist and...
Shout.
Now switch the T and the S. What do you get?
T.
Thous?
Thous, yes. Short for $1,000 bills. Here's your next one. Assignments for delivery drivers. And your second clue is former Supreme Court Justice David.
Repeat the first clue again, please, Will.
Uh-huh. Assignments for delivery drivers.
Okay, a route?
Yes, routes would be plural. Switch the R and the S.
Suitor.
Yes, David Suitor is right. And here's your last one. A small bag with a shoulder strap and some gate fasteners. This one's seven letters.
Small bag with a shoulder strap. A satchel?
Satchel is it. Good job. Switch the S and the L.
Okay, so latches.
Latches, you got it. You survive.
Survived is the right way to say it.
Yes, you did an awesome job. How do you feel?
Relieved it's over.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Mike, what member station do you listen to?
I'm a sustaining member for KQED 88.5 in San Francisco.
That is wonderful. That's Mike Rombach of Pleasanton, California. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Mike Reese, who's a showrunner, writer, and producer for The Simpsons. Think of a famous living singer. The last two letters of his first name and the first two letters of his last name spell a bird. Change the first letter of the singer's first name, then the first three letters of the first name and the last five letters of the last name together spell another bird. What singer is this? So again, a famous living singer, last two letters of the first name and first two letters of the last name spell a bird. Then you change the first letter of the first name. So then the first three letters of the first name and the last five letters of the last name spell another bird. What famous singer is this?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle. To submit your response, just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, December 11th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
There are certain things you expect from a place like New York City. Good food, Times Square, sure. But also big city pests like rats. A New York rat can even be a celebrity. Remember the pizza rat?
The internet blew up over this video of a rat carrying a whole slice of pizza down the stairs of a subway station.
That's Stephen Colbert on The Late Show, filmed in Manhattan, which is nowhere near Eagle, Idaho.
Rat apocalypse, it's a dramatic term, but I would just say that folks are very concerned. You know?
Feels like a 1980s New York City issue.
I live in Eagle, Idaho, ground zero for the rat race.
As the Idaho Statesman reports, Ada County, which includes the cities of Eagle and Boise, is struggling with rats.
They're catching 20 or 30 rats at their house, you know.
That's Adam Schroeder, director of Ada County Weed, Pest, and Mosquito Abatement. He says that in the past, rats were a non-issue. They weren't even considered in local pest control laws. Got a problem with marmots? Yellow-bellied gophers? No problem. But
we're not equipped to deal with rat infestations.
Ada County is growing. That could be the issue. It could also be due to container shipping. Whatever the cause, Schroeder says the area is beset, both with pizza rat type rats of the Norway variety. You know, the kind they look like Disney's Ratatouille. And another more acrobatic kind called roof rats. Boise City Council President Colin Nash just wants them gone. As he said at a recent city council meeting,
I am concerned if we're distinguishing between normal rats or rats that practice ninjutsu.
Enter Eagle resident Jane Rowling.
Well, I just gave myself the title of rat lady.
Rowling is retired, but had a 45-year long career in wildlife education.
So I'm a naturalist by profession.
Rowland never expected rats to be a problem in Eagle, but then she started seeing people post about them on the app next door.
Rats? We don't have any rats around here.
Rowland quickly got up to speed, helping people understand the do's and don'ts of rat prevention. In fact, Rowland says rats can really harm the animals that are supposed to be there, so she doesn't feel too bad about extermination. But the rats are probably going to stick around.
We're never going to eradicate all of them, just like no other city is.
Residents may need to get creative. An influx of hawks? An army of cats? Roland has another idea.
There's birth control for rats that I'm going to be promoting now.
Whatever it takes, residents of Ada County may need to learn to live with some rats in the neighborhood. But hey, at least it looks like they've hit the big leagues. Bigger the city, bigger the rats. Modern life means a tap, a voice, and suddenly you've reached your destination. But as NPR's Jackie Northam reports, what an old-fashioned atlas lacks in warnings about speed traps, it makes up for with history, culture, and art.
There's something special about a map that the GPS in your car or phone just can't provide. When laid out, a map can provide a greater sense of scale and place, hints at the allure of far-off lands. It's a reminder that we're a small part of a big world with a complex history. That's something the Osher Map Library at the University of Southern Maine in Portland reveals to students most days of the week. On this day, it's a group of energetic fourth graders.
London, France,
Paris,
Australia,
Arctic Ocean.
All right, friends, can I please come back over here?
The kids can view maps and globes, both modern and going back hundreds of years, from all over the world.
So this globe is over 400 years old. It is older than me. It is older than the United States. It is older than George Washington.
Many of the maps and globes put Europe as the focal point before America was mapped, giving the students a different perspective and orientation.
And if you actually go to Australia, they flip the map upside down so that Australia is on the top versus, like, you know, North America.
Maps are customized for each class. Up to 13,000 students go through the Osher Map Library and Smith Center for Cartographic Education every year. The founding donors wanted the maps open to all.
They wanted a second grader to be able to come in and see the oldest map. They wanted maps infused into every aspect of the curriculum.
Libby Bishop, the executive director, says a lot of institutions have archives and collections that sit in vaults, protected.
But the point here is to get them out and to use them and to make a new generation really excited about historic objects and historic materials.
Bischoff says the Osher Map Library is one of the largest in the country in terms of a collection that's open and accessible to the public.
We have about 500,000 maps, cartographic items, globes, atlases, books, dating back to 1475.
So this is the 1575 edition of the first systematic modern atlas called the Theater of the World.
Dr. Matthew Edney is the faculty scholar at the Osher Map Library, teaching a university course on global history. He relies on the library's vast collection of rare and unusual maps for the course.
I tell it through the lens of how have different cultures mapped their worlds, thinking of world as a cultural phenomenon, not just a physical thing.
Maps also reflect religious or geographical beliefs, power, ambition, and goals of various peoples and governments. Think Gulf of Mexico versus Gulf of America. One map at the Osher Library, titled Uprooted People of the USA, was produced in 1945 by Louise Jefferson, a black graphic designer and cartographer. It's a bright, colorful illustration of the widespread displacement in the U.S. at that time, says Bischoff.
You have refugees from Europe. You have all sorts of men and women going to fight and serve in the Army and Navy, being moved to train. She also maps Japanese internment.
The Osher Library has a very broad view of what defines a map. One, titled Willard's Temple of Time, charts the concept of time going back to the creation. There are celestial maps and books like the Nuremberg Chronicle, a complete and intact leather-bound tome from 1493 that's a history of the world. The pages are thick. You're allowed to touch it without gloves and feel the paper made hundreds of years ago.
It's made out of rags.
It's quite thick, isn't it?
Yes, it's thick paper, right?
Louis Miller, a librarian at the Osher, says the Nuremberg Chronicle contains more than 1,800 woodcut illustrations of cities.
My question is, how is this a map, though?
So I don't think that the entire book is a map, right? But those views of cities are definitely maps.
The illustrations are finely detailed views of buildings within the cities. Miller says a forerunner, if you like, for what we use now.
Anything that Google is doing now with Street View, things like that, is borrowing off of a convention that maps have been using for hundreds and hundreds of years.
One of the newest maps at the library is a funeral shroud from India that belonged to a member of the Jain religion. It's a pale blue and saffron-colored cosmological map of the entirety of creation and human-divine relationships. It shows land and rivers and mountains. Edney again.
It is stunning. I literally just saw this 2 minutes after you walked in. So
We just bought this.
The Osher Map Library actively searches for and buys maps to add to their teaching collection. And there are some unexpected finds. Edney says he had long coveted one of the Yagi celestial maps from the late 1900s, but the library was always outbid. Then, one day it showed up.
A woman was cleaning out her uncle's house in central North Maine, and it was in the rafters of the breezeway. And she went to the Maine Historical Society, and they said, oh, no, we don't really want this, but you should go to the Osher Map Library, and voila, we have it.
And how did it feel when you saw it?
It was gorgeous. It really is.
Bischoff says you never know when a map is going to appear, from a map dealer, the corner of an attic, a forgotten box. But when it does, it becomes more than a piece of paper. It's an insight into history and cultures, and a glimpse at how people have seen and imagined their world. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Portland.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From StoryWorth, each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. and from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text or donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the right time to give to KAXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps people-powered radio strong and ensures a bright future for KAXE. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. And tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. And don't forget to visit our website, kaxe.org, for the latest Up North report, bright spot, set list,